Welcome to the My Canine Coach podcast, a show that coaches dog owners on how to achieve their ideal lifestyle with and for their dogs. You'll hear from Canine Coach Dana as she breaks down actionable dog training protocols, explores current dog training trends, and shares insights from her own experiences owning and working with dogs. Now, here's your host, Canine Coach Dana. Hey, welcome back to another episode of the My Canine Coach podcast. I'm your host, Canine Coach Dana, and I'm joined by my co-host Loki, who is my Bohemian Shepherd. Today, we're going to be doing things a little bit differently on the podcast. And instead of me picking a topic and exploring it with you all, I'm going to pick your topics and answer your questions. I've gotten a few questions in, and I wanted to answer them for the people who asked here in a podcast form, because most of the time, the questions that I get asked are not unique to just that one owner. Most of the time, everyone else is actually also wondering the same thing or maybe experiencing the same thing. So we're going to go public with our answers here so that everyone gets to hear how I would address or approach each of the situations that I've gotten questions about. But before I get into the questions that you sent in, I want to give a shout out actually to a stranger. She probably does not listen to the podcast, so she'll likely never hear this, but she still deserves my thanks. I was at Saratoga State Park the other day training Loki, which is a massive state park in upstate New York, for those of you who listen and aren't from this area. Anyway, I was there working on Loki's reactivity, and he was having this big blow up when these two women were walking at us to get themselves and their two dogs into their car. So they're like walking towards us, and I've got Loki next to me having this big reactivity event. I'm doing my thing, and I'm trying to regulate myself as I train through that situation, while also noticing how Loki is doing so that I can be adjusting what I need to be doing in real time to his choices. So everything's really happening very quickly. And I keep looking up at these women so that I know when they've gotten in their car so I could move on to the next phase of that training setup that I would need to do once the people and the dogs were out of sight. So I was working through that, and as Loki's having this big barking his head off, trying to drive forward at the end of his leash whole situation, I keep glancing up and like looking at them, making eye contact accidentally, because I'm just trying to watch when they're getting in their car. And one of the women actually shouts over to me, "Your dog is so beautiful. You have a really beautiful dog." And that completely bowled me over in that moment and took so much pressure off of me. Because as owners of reactive dogs, when we're trying to work through their reactivity and it goes unexpectedly or it just looks really messy, we get insecure about what that looks like to other people. And as much as I've worked this job, you can't help but feel personal about it, especially when it's your own dog, because you're out there working on something that's extremely challenging, and it feels like the problem exists because of you, or that you're part of the problem that your dog is having. So it's hard not to take that situation really personally. And when people are noticing that your dog is struggling, we can sometimes internalize that and feel that they're not just noticing that our dog is struggling, they're noticing that we're struggling, and that makes us feel insecure, and it can make us feel judged. Even though the people may not be doing that, we can often interpret it that way, or it feels that way. And it's only because you care so much about trying to help your dog feel better about that situation. You really, really are hoping that it goes well, and when it doesn't, or when your dog has a really big, messy reaction, it feels really shitty. As owners of reactive dogs who are going through reactivity training, the reason why we're going through the reactivity training is hopefully, first of all, to help our dogs feel better. That's truly should be your main motivator, I think, if you're going to work on reactivity. Reactivity stems from an overwhelm of emotion. And I would love for Loki to not feel so overcome by his emotions and be better at regulating himself so he doesn't get so over aroused or over consumed or stressed. I'm trying to take all of that negative emotional baggage and lessen it for him. And secondarily, we want to help our dogs have a better life. That's really the other reason. And we want to have a better life with our dogs. So we're also tied into that. We want to be able to take our dog to go do things. We want to say yes to people when they invite us and our dog to go to the cafe or to go on a hike or a walk or something like that, or to go over to a friend's house. We want to be able to say yes to those things. But when you have a reactive dog or if you have an aggressive dog, oftentimes you're limiting what their life experiences are. So when working through reactivity, a lot of times our driver, our motivators to helping our dog get better is so that not only can they feel better, but so that we can feel better too and our lives get bigger. We get to say yes to more things. So there's a lot of emotional motivation that gets tied into reactivity training. And because our dogs are being reactive out of an emotional state, or it's their reactivity is being driven by an emotional state, both you and the dog are often in a negative, we'll call it a negative, emotional place when you're working through reactivity and in the actual training moment. So for someone to say something that takes you out of that headspace, it floored me in that moment, honestly. And it stopped the voice in my head that was saying, oh my gosh, other people are watching. Your dog is having a really hard time. Maybe they're thinking that your dog is a danger or that you have no control over your dog. What are you doing out in public? Like all of those negative thoughts come racing through because some people unfortunately do have those opinions and you can hear them from time to time. And when you're in the thick of it, it's hard to not let those thoughts come in, especially when other people are watching. But this lady, like, she's just a champ. Maybe she's lived this life too and she gets it. Maybe she's owned a reactive dog before. The dog that she was with when I saw her that day had no problem with Loki barking at him or her. But maybe she understands the stress of owning a reactive dog, or maybe she just took that scene in and realized that we were trying. I wasn't just standing there letting Loki be loud and obnoxious. I was attempting to help train through the situation. So maybe she saw that and decided, you know, I'm going to pay that person a compliment because I see that they're trying. So she chose to lift me up by telling me that Loki was beautiful when he was being a crazy lunatic. And maybe I'm reading too much into it. Maybe she really just didn't give a shit that my dog was barking and really thought that he was beautiful. But I'm going to choose to believe that she wanted to offer some form of support and wanted to recognize our efforts. And the way that she chose to do that was by just paying us a compliment. So I wish that I could thank her properly. I couldn't in the moment, obviously, because I was training, so I couldn't stop what I was doing. And I'm probably not going to see her again. Maybe I'll have a full circle moment and we'll run into each other again at the park, but I doubt it. And she probably has no idea that I've been thinking about that still, or how much that really did help de-stress me in that moment. But at the very least, I'm going on record here and now and saying thank you. I think we forget sometimes how easy it is to show support towards other people. And just by paying them a simple compliment, you can really change their headspace. And we should do more of that. So thank you, stranger. But now it's my turn to support you all by answering your questions. We have three questions that I'm going to answer today. This first one is from an owner who wished to remain anonymous. They ask, hello, I have two dogs, poodles. They're over a year. One has food aggression. While she is eating, the other dog comes over to sniff her food and she will growl until eventually she pounces and they both growl and have open mouths. It doesn't happen every time, but it does sometimes. Why does this happen and how can I stop it? All right, let's start with why this happens. A lot of times we forget that the dogs that we live with and we snuggle with and laugh at their goofy antics are still primal animals. Dogs have become domesticated, yes, and they look far different on the outside from the ancestors that they evolved from, but they are still driven to act by survival instincts, and one of the rules of their world is defending or protecting food resources. In order to survive, they have to eat. So it doesn't matter how much your dogs get along, they each are going to set the other one straight if one of them is encroaching on their food. If you observe pack animals, and yes, we're talking about dogs, so it's an easy parallel for me to jump over to talking about wolves, but really animals of any pack nature, even if we look at lions, they defend their right to the pack's food source from other pack members by posturing over the food, baring their teeth, growling, and lunging if necessary to get the other member of the pack to leave their space and leave their food alone. So your dog still has all of those base instincts driving its behavior if it's placed in that similar situation. It's entirely appropriate in their world to defend their food from others. Now, we as pet parents don't want to see that happening, of course. Yes, it may be appropriate for them to do that, but it's not something that we want to see in our household. We don't want one dog to get hurt, or we don't want to be dealing with fights between our dogs. We want them to get along. So in this situation, the dog that is defending its food is technically in the right. The other dog is encroaching on its space while it's eating, and that can appropriately be interpreted as a threat to the first dog's food. So this dog is doing what it should be doing, is what I'm trying to get at. But what it's also doing is giving a lot of warning signs before pouncing, as they described. Like if I go back, let's see. Yep, so they say that she will growl until she eventually pounces, and then they both kind of go at each other for a little bit. So what that tells me when I'm reading that is that the first dog doesn't really actually want to fight the other dog. It's giving a lot of subtle signs first to see if those are enough to tell the other dog to step away. But when that other dog isn't listening to the teeth baring, the side eye, the posturing over the food, or the growling, then that first dog has to get louder in what it's trying to say. And the way that dogs do that is by becoming more physical. And so then we see that first dog lunge at the other one, and then they bare their teeth and they kind of go into that whole display. So that's what's happening in those moments, and that's why that's happening. But what do we do about this? And this is, by the way, this is a PSA for all dog owners who own multiple dogs. When it comes to feeding your dogs, and I mean feeding them anything, meals, bones, Kongs, treats, any form of food, please separate your dogs. There's no need or reason to feed them together. All you're doing is taking an unnecessary risk. By simply separating your dogs, you can avoid almost 100% of fights over food. Like 99.9, because nothing is ever 100, 99.9% of this is solved just by separating your dogs when they have a food item. So you would feed one in one room and one in another room with a closed door between them. We need a solid barrier between them. Typically gates, I don't trust. I don't like those. That's not enough for me because it's only a partial barrier and a dog can get through a gate if they really want to charge it or if they want to jump it, they can get over it. So I do like a closed door. Or you can feed them both in their crates. It's best if those crates are not right next to each other or like side by side. If they're separated from each other, that's the best. Or if you have kennels, you can feed each dog in its kennel. It takes slightly more effort from you, but it's a must in my book for any owner who has more than one dog. Because why take the risk? Why put your dogs in a situation where they may have to defend their food? It's just entirely unnecessary because, like I said, these are base primal instincts. And if they're put in a situation where they feel they need to defend it, they are going to do so. So let's just not put them in that situation in the first place. Just separate your dogs and you'll likely no longer have this problem, especially if this is the only time that your two dogs are really showing behavior like this. Like if they don't fight over anything else, they only kind of have this little tiff when it has to do with mealtime, then just separating them will get rid of this issue for you, most likely. Because like I said, and how I read the question, this first dog doesn't really want to cause conflict. Like, they don't want to get into conflict with the second one because they're giving a lot of signs first before they escalate to lunging at the second dog. So they don't really want to get into a fight with each other. They're just being pressed into it. So just separate them. Actually, as I was putting together my notes for this episode, I put out a post on my Instagram that was a PSA for all dog owners who have multiple dogs: separate your dogs when you feed them. Let's share that and make sure that many people see that, because I think a lot of owners just don't even, it's not that they don't consider it, but it just doesn't even cross their mind as an option, basically, when they have multiple dogs, that they can do that. They think like, oh, it's mealtime, I got to feed the dogs, and we just feed them together because we're a family, we do things together. So, or it's just easier for me to get two bowls ready and put them down next to or near each other. And they just don't even think to separate them when they do meals. So let's circulate that post so that a lot of people see that, and we stop a lot of fights with a simple solution of just separating dogs when they eat. Moving on to the next question that was sent in. This one reads, I've had my dog for 3 months now. He is a year and a half old and uses my hands as a chew toy when he wants attention from me or when we're playing. Usually it happens when we're playing with a toy. He'll all of a sudden switch from playing with the toy to playing with my hand. I'll try to get him to stop and go back to biting on the toy, but he just keeps going after my hand. How can I get him to stop thinking that my hand is a plaything and only play with the toy? All right, this is something that comes up a lot. It's super common in younger dogs who have a hard time controlling their impulses and they have a lot of high energy to play with. What's often happening is the dog is playing with the toy because the toy is animated and moving unpredictably, like around, because you're doing that with your hand. You're making the toy very fun. It turns into this really fun chase game. But sometimes that chasing gets redirected to your hand because it's your hand that's doing the same movements, or really it's your hand that's the true cause of those movements. So your dog's focus shifts from the toy to your hand. When Loki was a puppy and when Coda, my first dog, was a puppy, they both struggled to stay on the toy. That's what we would call it in dog training terms. They'd often switch to seeking my hand when we played. And my favorite way to address this is by showing the dog that the opposite of what they're hoping for is actually going to happen if they make contact with my skin or my sleeve. So when they go for your hand or your sleeve, they're expecting the play to continue. They're expecting that they're going to get to keep interacting with you. So what I do, and what I coach my clients to do, is to stop playing with them and remove their access to you temporarily. This way, we're showing the dog that the opposite of what they expected to happen actually results when they do that behavior that we don't like, which is the biting on our hand or our sleeve. I also make sure that we use a word or a sound at that moment that they bite you to mark the exact thing that they did that's causing you to no longer want to interact with them. That's just a sound that we use to make the moment stand out to the dog that's causing you to no longer want to interact with them. So it's very obvious to the dog what it is that's causing you to leave. So what that looks like is saying no right when they bite you, like as soon as their teeth make contact with your skin or your sleeve. Then what you would do is you would change your body language. So when you're playing, you're very happy, you're excited, you're probably making funny sounds, and your body language is very loose and you're smiley. When you're showing them, hey, actually, I don't like that you did that, and we're trying to use this protocol to get them to stop doing that, we want to change our body language so that we kind of show them that we have what I call the ick, where you don't really want to be around that person or that dog. They give you the ick. You kind of want to give them like the cold shoulder. If they came into your space, it would kind of make you feel uncomfortable and you would want to move away. That's the type of body language that I'm looking for you to showcase to your dog. And then what you want to do is remove their access to you. The easiest way to do that is by stepping over a baby gate so that You can still see what your dog is up to on the other side of the gate, especially if you have a puppy. We don't want them going after something while we're trying to make this point. And you want to act like you have that ick. You don't want anything to do with them for just like 30 seconds or so. This whole protocol is a form of social punishment. So the dog learns by the situation repeating again and again every time they make contact with your hand or your sleeve that they actually become outcasted temporarily by the group when they act like that. That surprise or that unexpected happening actually is when the learning moment happens for your dog. We actually don't learn anything unless we're surprised or something outside of our expectations occur. Our dog thinks, oh, I'm going to chew on your hand, I'm going to chew on your sleeve, we're going to get to keep playing. But actually all of a sudden, what they expected to happen doesn't, and that causes them to pay attention. Their brain starts wondering, okay, what was it that just happened that caused this moment that I didn't predict to happen to actually happen? And how can I prevent that from happening in the future? Because I don't like this moment that comes after I bite their hand or bite their sleeve. They learn as we repeat this event over and over and over again that, oh, it's always that when I make contact with their hand or I make contact with their sleeve, that then those events follow where I kind of get outcasted and I don't actually get to interact with that person anymore, which is what I actually really wanted to keep doing. So your dog actually learns to modify their behavior because they're social creatures. And in this specific scenario, they are seeking social interaction. So if something that they do causes that social interaction to go away, they're going to modify what they're doing to prevent that from happening again. And that's why this is called social punishment. They're losing access to interacting socially. Now, after those 30 seconds are up, what I want you to do is return to your dog with neutral, normal energy. If you want, you can go start up playing with them again. But remember to follow these steps every single time that they bite you in order to show them that it's not allowed. We want to really impress upon them that this is part of the rules of this game, basically. You're not allowed to put your teeth on me. If you do, then the whole game stops and we don't get to interact anymore. Now, if you find, though, that you get stuck in a loop where you keep returning and going back to your dog and then starting to play with them again just for your dog to go after your hand again every single time, then I would say just give it a rest. Don't keep playing. This is really common to happen with puppies. They have a hard time controlling their impulses and also takes them a bit to pick up on this pattern of biting you is actually resulting in the play stopping because their brains just aren't developed enough. They're not cognitively able to pick up on that as quickly as an adult dog. So in that case, I would return to your dog and just go about your business. Just do whatever you want to do beyond playing with your dog. If you're doing stuff around the house, just start doing stuff around the house. If you want to watch TV, watch TV. Just don't go back to playing, basically, but be normal. If they start to play with you, though, and they're like, oh my God, you came back, let's go back to playing, and they start kind of jumping on you, or they are biting at you, or trying to, you know, get at your legs or your pants, then they just really need a break, and they need to cool down to come down from that arousal and excitement that they were just experiencing. Crate time would be a really good thing to do at that point, or tethering, or putting them in a pen, or you can send them to place if they know that cue. Really what's happening is they just got a little too amped. They need some space to calm back down. When they're too amped and too excited, they're also not able to learn because they're not thinking critically through their actions. They're just acting on impulse. So they're also not going to learn if you stay in that loop. They're not going to be learning anything because they're just going to be in this super highly aroused state and no learning is actually going to be happening. They need some space and some time to cool down and come down and back into their brains and out of their body. All right, but that's how I would address that. I would show the dog that the opposite of what they expect to happen is actually going to happen. And I would repeat that over and over and over again. As you do, you should see one of three or all three of these markers start to decrease. So either you'll notice that the intensity of the biting will start to decrease, the frequency at which it's happening, so how often your dog is going after your hands when you're playing with them, will also start to decrease, or that will be the first one that starts to go. or the third one, the duration of the biting will decrease, or that will be the first indicator that this is working and it's being effective, that will start to drop out and go down. Not duration as in how long they're biting your hand in one single bite, but how long they're continuing to go after your hand and persist in that behavior when it's not actually working. You'd notice that they're not as pushy about trying to get that to be the thing that gets you to keep playing with them. They'd give up on it sooner. So if you notice any one of those three aspects of their behavior start to decrease, then you'll know that you're on the right track and that the social punishment is working, because either the intensity, the frequency, or the duration of the biting at your hands is starting to come down or go away. Our third and final question comes from Haley. She asks, how can I stop my dog from begging for our food? Whenever we eat, she claws at our legs, barks, even tries to jump and steal food from my daughter's hands, and has succeeded. If we put her in another room, she'll just bark continuously. She's 2 years old, and we want to nip this in the bud. Any advice? Okay, so I just actually had a client with a golden retriever that would bark at them when they ate dinner as a family, and it would just like act really pushy basically for the food and would try to like steal food. And so what we did was teach their dog what I call polite begging. And this is a training technique that I use, and that's what I call it. I don't know if other trainers call it that. I don't know if they teach this, but this is what I train. Before I explain what polite begging is, I do want to say you can address this type of behavior by simply putting your dog in a crate when you eat if they're already crate trained. But what I've found is that if a dog is already used to barking for the food, putting them in the crate isn't going to get them to stop the barking part. They'll just bark from within there. You'll stop all the other parts of the behavior that you don't like, where they're jumping up at you or trying to steal food or climbing your lap or, you know, any of those types of things. Like, that will go away because they're stuck in a crate. But the barking typically doesn't, because they're still frustrated and they still want to get the food. And now they're even further away from their goal. So actually it can cause the barking behavior to escalate. So that's typically not always the way that I go about it. If you have a dog who's barking while begging, if you have a dog that's just being pushy, you can try that first and see if that just helps remove them from the whole situation. And then you're not really training through it, but you're just removing the problem, and they're actually no longer practicing doing that, and they can get used to basically going in their crate whenever you eat. That might be a solution for you if you don't really have a barker. But in this scenario, she did say that the dog's barking and pushy and stealing food from people's hands. So what I would actually do is go through my protocol for teaching polite begging. So polite begging is where we train the dog to go to a specific place while the family eats. And so long as the dog is on that spot, it has the opportunity to earn the very food that the family is eating, so long as the food is dog safe, of course. Now, this can be any spot in your house that's near where you eat. You need to be able to see your dog. Your dog needs to be able to see you. I like to teach the dog to go to a cot or a bed, something that stands out as a physical place where they can go, rather than just a general spot on the floor, because it's usually much easier for the dog to pick up on where they need to be, because it's a physical location that's very obvious to them when they're on it versus off it. So it's very obvious when you're on the cot versus on the floor or on the carpet. I did this with Loki, and I honed this process with Coda, and we started from when they were puppies. Every time I would eat, I would periodically place or toss food onto a cot for them to go eat. So they'd get my food, but it would end up on the cot for them to go have. Over time, what they would do is they would begin to gravitate toward the cot whenever I was eating. And that's just because they learned that, oh, that's a hot spot. Whenever she's doing that thing where she's sitting at the table and eating food, food seems to magically appear over here on this cot. So I'm just going to go near that area, because that seems to be like a good place to be whenever she's doing that. When I would notice that they'd move closer to it, or even if they went onto it, I would make sure in those moments to toss them food So they knew that it paid to be on or near that cot. It's like a game of hot and cold. Anytime they started to move in the direction that I wanted them to go or got right to the spot where I wanted them to be, I made sure that they were being rewarded for those efforts. Basically, I was telling them that they were on the right track. Going over to the cot is the thing that I'm looking for, and within a short amount of time, they would run to their cot whenever I would walk over to the table with my plate, because they knew that if they were over near the cot, they'd be getting food. Or really, they knew that the cot would magically produce food, and that's where they wanted to be. So in this scenario, yes, technically, your dog is still begging, because they're doing some type of behavior in order to get the food that you're eating. It's just that we've hacked it in a way that they're doing a behavior that we actually like, and they're not being pushy or annoying about it. We get what we want, and the dog gets what they want, so it's a win-win. In the case of my client whose dog was barking as well, once we showed him how he can rig the system, or like in his mind, how he can successfully get the food that he wants, he was no longer frustrated by the uncertainty of not knowing when his opportunity would strike or how he would be able to get that food, so he stopped barking. A lot of the barking that happens when a dog is begging is because, well, usually it's one of two things. Either one, they've learned that barking will get you to do what they want because you want the barking to stop, and a lot of people will accidentally just give in to the barking, and then the dog learns like, oh, barking works. If I bark, they'll give me food, because you get so frustrated that you're like, fine, here's some food. If you haven't done that, then typically the barking is stemming from frustration. The dog has had moments where it has gotten the food before, but not on a consistent basis or in a reliable way where it knows with certainty that it can get food if it does a specific thing. This dog was young, just like this person's describing. Haley said that her dog's 2 years old. It was young, so it struggled to control its impulses, and it had a difficult time dealing with the uncertainty of not knowing when or how it was going to get food, and that's what was leading to frustration, which would come out in the form of barking. Oh my God, I'm so frustrated. I want that so badly, but I don't know how I can get it. I know sometimes I can get it, but I typically can't get it in the same manner every single time, and that's really frustrating to me, and so that's why I'm barking. When we then show that dog, hey, this behavior, going over to your cot or going over to your bed, will consistently result in you getting food, the dog's no longer frustrated, because it knows exactly what it needs to do in order to get the thing that it wants. It has clarity. And when you have a dog that's no longer frustrated, the barking magically goes away. I mean, not magically. We did train it out, basically. But it looks magical because I didn't do anything and they didn't do anything to correct the barking or to punish the dog for barking to get them to stop barking. We just taught the dog to go to a cot, and as a fallout, a good fallout, the dog stopped barking because now it's not frustrated. So once my client's dog did learn to go to his cot consistently every time they ate, they would back off on how often they would reward him for being there. So in the beginning, they're rewarding him pretty frequently so that he learns like, okay, this is definitely, I'm on the right track. I keep getting food here. This is the thing that I should do. But once he started to showcase that like, oh, I know this is the thing that I should do, we started to back off on how often we would throw him a piece of food from the table. And by the end of it, he'd get like one or two pieces per meal, which is just enough of an advantage for him that would make him want to go over to his cot and stay there, but not so many instances of throwing him food that the family felt like they were really interrupting their mealtime to focus on their dog's training. And that's basically where I landed with Loki as well. I'll throw him like one piece in the middle of the meal, and at the end of the meal, if he's lucky, if my whole plate is dog safe, he can lick my plate. Before I put it in the dishwasher, don't worry, I still wash it. Or at the end of the meal, like I'll give him something else at the end. But I'm not sitting there constantly throwing food over to my dog while I'm eating. I'm still enjoying my meal. I'm still talking to whoever I'm talking to. But there are like one, two, maybe three instances where I'm going to switch gears and focus on my dog for a second and give him a reward for doing the polite begging that we've trained him to do. So that's how you teach polite begging. I like it. I recommend it. I teach it. It works. It's not difficult to teach. You can reach out to me if you want help with it. But I think with what I described, you could get away with just listening through and working on it on your own. I'm pretty sure you could get it done. And those are all the questions that I'm going to answer this time around. If you have a specific training question that you want answered like this on the podcast, post it in the Facebook group. Or if you would prefer to stay anonymous, you can send me an email with your question. Just make sure that you use podcast question as your subject line so I know that's why you're sending it in, and I'll make sure to answer it for you. The link to that Facebook group and the link to my email are listed below in the show notes, so you can get all that info there. I really liked this style episode. I get a lot of questions in, and I find that a lot of us have the same questions, and some of us are just afraid to ask them. So I like being able to answer them in a podcast form so everybody gets to hear the answers. Do you guys like this style of an episode? I know that in at least one prior episode, I answered someone's question directly, but I think I only did one. I didn't go through a bunch of them. Do you like this style that I did a bunch of them in a row? Do you want me to do more of these? Let me know in the Facebook group what you think of this style episode, and maybe I'll do some more. Or actually what I can do is I'll put a poll up in there for people to vote, and then that way you can tell me if you like this format. Or actually, if you send me a bunch of questions, then I'll know that you guys like this format and you want more of these, in which case I'll do more of them. If you'd like to get in touch with me about training or to give feedback or to ask a question, the best way to do that is by visiting my website, mycaninecoach.com, and requesting a consult. Or you can send me an email at caninecoachdana@gmail.com. Once again, you guessed it, both of those are listed in the show notes. You can also join the Facebook group. I recommend that. Go join that Facebook group for the podcast if you're looking to connect with other cool dog people, or you're looking to crowdsource information about dogs or training. That's a great spot to do that. The link to that, surprise, surprise, is in the show notes. If you want a direct connection to me, you can subscribe to my email list via my website, and you can get updates from all things Canine Coach. You get training tips, alerts when episodes drop, and for my email list people, I send a newsletter in the middle of each month that recaps all the major points of that month's podcast episode. So you don't have to go back and listen to the full episode to review all of the highlights. You can just go read that email. So if you want that, jump on those emails, go subscribe. But most importantly, the biggest ask I can ask of you is to give this show a review. Please help the show grow by giving us a review. That's the best way that the internets are going to share and recommend it to more listeners. So please do that for me. I'd really appreciate it. But that's it for this episode. I'll see you next time. Loki and I are going to go do some cool dog stuff.